Welcome to Passy Muir's CAM Podcast, Conversations on Air and Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Michelle Dawson, having a conversation on pediatric feeding disorders.
Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you back to our Conversations on Air and Digestive Management, the CAM Podcast. And today I have the pleasure of talking with Michelle Dawson, a speech language pathologist. And Michelle, first, I just want to welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad the boys stopped by your booth at Skisha to play with the little baby train.
Me too. Oh, and it's funny because I'll share that because that is how I met you. I was at a conference in the booth and you had your boys help out with a little focus group thing that we were doing. And they were so gracious to join in and the smart guys that they were and helped out and let me get a little feedback on something that we were working on. So that was fun. And then through them, I actually met you through your boys, basically when I asked permission. But I want to do a little intro too, Michelle, and share with people kind of your background and you know, what you bring to the table, because you are very well known for your work with pediatric feeding disorders and working in the realm of children who may be picky eaters or have dysphagia, but all things related to pediatric feeding disorders. And we're going to touch a little on that in the podcast. But first, I want to share with everyone a little bit about your background, and then I'll let you share, because the main way that I got to know of you after meeting you at the conference is through the podcast that you host, because you host First Bite, Fed, Fun, and Functional. Did I get that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And it's a weekly podcast for speech therapists. It offers continuing education also. And I also want to share that you recently authored Chasing the Swallow, Truth, Science, and Hope for Pediatric Feeding and Swallowing Disorders. And I'll let you share a little bit about your publication, your podcast, and then also, I know you have a few other disclosures and areas of interest and things that you're doing. Do you mind sharing what those are?
Yeah. So when you read my CV, it kind of looks like I have my life together. It looks really good on paper. And I'm aware of that, right? Some of my disclosures, I'm topic chair for ASHA for the Pediatric Feeding Disorder and Dysphagia topic committee for this year for ASHA 2023. So everybody come say hi at ASHA, because like we're in Boston and it's amazing. And we have so many invited topics on interprofessional practice for peds, dysphagia, and PFD, which can kind of get lumped into one beautiful title of PFD. I have served as past president for the South Carolina Speech Hearing Association. I've been treasurer for the Council of State Association Presidents. I have poured as much energy as my body has to spare into advocacy for those that cannot advocate for themselves, because they are the littlest ones that we're called to serve, right? So I champion and raise awareness about what PFD is and how to engage in current evidence-based practice and how to avoid the pitfalls of social media. I do all of those things and I love what I do. And this coming in a month, in less than a month, I will be the new clinic director at James Madison University and assistant professor. And I'll be putting pediatric feeding and swallowing disorders in the university clinic, which will be the first time JMU has, to my knowledge, had that service in their university clinic, which is an amazing opportunity to train our future colleagues in what best practice looks like. And I did this at Francis Marion University, which was just the chance of a lifetime, because it was the first time we could put PFD and dysphagia in a university clinic in all of South Carolina. And Dr. Francis Burns, who was the chair there, I gave her my dream. I voiced it into the universe and she gave me a place and support and love to nourish it, right? But when you look at all of this and it looks well put together, what is not seen in black and white is I truly do have a tad bit of the ADD, ADHD, and anxiety and PTSD. I am a domestic abuse survivor from a very violent first marriage. And not everyone knows that. I mean, the statistics are one in four partners. And so if we carry that statistic over, then because of the work that I do, I treat pediatric patients that have hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy. I've had several that have HIE with a comorbidity of oropharyngeal dysphagia and pediatric feeding disorder because their mothers were abused during their pregnancy. So this is very real to the work that I do. Babies with non-accidental trauma because the partners were abusive to the caregivers, but also abusive to the children. And then now this child's whole world has changed and they need the services that I can deliver, the work that I can do. But I have to filter my personal trauma and put it to the side so that I can be fully present. And that's kind of why caregiver coaching and interprofessional practice team building is so core to me for what we do, because I wouldn't be able to render the services had I not had my own team to get me to where I am. And each child, same to be said for adult dysphagia, they're as good as the team that is behind the patient and the caregiver.
Yeah, that is very true. And I think that, you know, as practicing clinicians, we can't help. I know you said set it aside, but where we come from mm-hmm. kind of makes us who we are. And it does color how we approach things and how we look at different situations. And I think that having that empathy, that knowledge that you have, and being able to provide that level of background knowledge and empathy to help your patients is that's something that most people can't do. And I think that everyone who sees you is lucky to have that, or for the students who train under you to have, whether they shared the full story or not, to have that level of experience kind of brought to their training to help them understand better what people are potentially going through.
I've served as clinic coordinator at FMU, and then I'm getting ready to step into it at JMU. And one of the pieces that I brought in was we are in a society that's not giving full attention to mental health the way that it should. And when we're caregivers, that's our job. I am a speech language pathologist. I'm part of allied health, but the crux of our profession is we're caregivers. As my daddy would say, we're healers. And the way my family describes it is we're healers. But if you're not healed, then how are you going to pay it forward? So one of the pieces that I do when I pull in is I work so closely with the university's counseling department. So that way, like embedded within those first rounds of like clinic coursework, we're learning what services are available to our students, as well as to our faculties, as well as to like resources. Whenever I have a friend that's getting a job at like a major healthcare system, I'm like, check out what counseling and check out what psych they have, not just for patients, but for yourself, because you're going to have bad days. You're going to have bad weeks. The pandemic taught us this. And so by setting them for success through learning how to create strategies for support, we're helping them fully comprehend Maslow's scale of hierarchical need. And they're building on that Sturm foundation, building on your rocks. And then they're less likely to shift and they're better able, just like you said, to coach through that. So, yeah.
Well, that leads really nicely into what we were going to focus on today. But I want to first share, as a professor myself in my previous life, but as a professor myself, one of the areas that was missing in our program and that I was able to, I contributed a tiny amount to it because it was missing, but it wasn't my primary focus. And that was pediatric feeding disorders. Mm-hmm. And so I had one elective course that I would offer that students could take, but otherwise they really didn't have that opportunity. And I see that in a lot of programs where there's not that opportunity for students to have exposure to pediatric feeding disorders. And they may get, well, I shouldn't say, they might get exposure. They might get a little bit in a course or even have a course on it, but they don't get that opportunity to be embedded in it more and really yes. learn about it. Like you're talking about starting at JMU. So yes. I'm just thrilled when you shared that disclosure that you're going to be able to offer that to the students at JMU and that we're going to have, as you said, colleagues coming out who have had that experience and can bring hopefully more awareness as you're trying to do, more awareness to pediatric feeding disorders and what is needed. Because I think pediatrics as a whole, from a speech language pathology standpoint on the medical side, and I say medical meaning like the dysphagia, the feeding disorders, traumatic brain injuries, all of that, any of those types of occurrences or comorbidities that are going on really don't get enough focus our profession.
They don't. And what happens is, and this is something that I would love to see addressed. So full disclosure, I'm in the process of sitting for my BCSS, right? So I am acutely aware that the board certified specialist in swallowing disorders has split, right? So now you can take, not split, but the test, you can now take a pediatric geared test or an adult geared test, right? However, embedded within ASHA, our SIG 13 still encompasses all across the life continuum, but our ASHA topic chair committees, our ASHA topic committees have split. So now we have an adult dysphagia and a peds dysphagia, but this is the third year in. Dr. Goza, Memory Goza, who's the chair at University of Alabama, she set up she was the first topic chair for peds dysphagia and pediatric feeding disorders for the last 2 years. And then I got nominated to do it. And so when I came in, because this is still fresh, this ICD-10 code for PFD, R63.32 and R63.31, I believe it is, chronic and then acute. These are new ICD-10 codes that are fresh from the advocacy work that Feeding Matters created. And I promise I'll loop back to that thought process. But what we see is that as a general rule of thumb, this term is still misunderstood, the overall term pediatric feeding disorder. So what happens is that we have graduate programs that teach peds dysphagia, and in most programs, it's one or two nights embedded within the greater dysphagia class, right? And honestly, I can name four universities where I've been called in to teach those classes for that one or two nights, right? That's all that they get. But their adult dysphagia professors recognize, hey, this is something that I don't do, something that I don't know anything about. So can you come in and talk about PFD and how dysphagia fits under that umbrella? Now, that being said, I do teach the peds dysphagia class at University of South Carolina. I taught that for their distance program and their on-campus program this past spring semester. But when I inherited the course description, the course outline, it still was restricted to peds dysphagia. And it didn't take into account the true definition of pediatric feeding disorder and how peds dysphagia is embedded within that. And that's so, like at GMU, for example, they have a pediatric dysphagia class, but it's now taking it that next step of putting in the on-campus practicum, that clinical piece where you're doing research academic into practice. And that is current evidence-based practice. That's what we need, is we need a place where we're learning it, but then we're applying it. Because here's what I see. This is the feedback that I get. Well, we don't have to put this in the university clinic. I've literally been told this, because we don't think it's safe. We don't think we should treat dysphagia here. And the students aren't going to see it in their like school practicums. I mean, those are like smatterings of feedback that I've gotten. I'm like, oi, but they are, because I helped volunteer to write the thing. So South Carolina, starting sometime soon, under the tutelage and leadership of Angie Neal, who's the lead department of ed SLP for South Carolina. Brilliant. Angie's like the goddess of R, like R tick and dyslexia. Oh my gosh, this woman is, oh, I hold her in the highest regard. Angie and I helped write SIG chapter 13, which is kind of funny because it's chapter 13 and SIG 13, but whatever. And it's all about PFD in the public schools. Now we can go all the way back to Emily Homer out of New Orleans, where they started PFD in the public schools back under the umbrella when it was just peds dysphagia. But we've had this constant evolution in what PFD means, and even school-based clinicians are receiving students and patients that 10 years ago wouldn't survive. 10 years ago, wouldn't have had all your trachs, vents. These babies are living And now they're going to school to learn, but they have to eat. Because if your body is not nourished, if you are not fed, you are not ready to learn. It's a lot. I got excited.
Oh, no, I loved it. No, and you're right. I mean, that's, and I've wrote an article not too long ago where I talked in the beginning about, you know, the babies, they're surviving now. We have a much higher survival rate and lower mortality rate than we used to have. But now what do we do with them? You know what I'm saying? Like, because there are, you're seeing more PFD in the schools. You're seeing more children with acquired brain injuries and, you know, different things that have happened from birth trauma or whether they were premature or, you know, just different things that are happening. These babies are surviving and then they're becoming our school age kids.
Yes.
And, you know, what services do we provide? And it's funny because I've pushed a lot of people say, oh, school's not medical. And I'm like, if your school's, you're medical.
You are. Like, and
it's not and separate. You can't.
Yes, but you also, but you can be. And that's, as women, we don't want to, and I'm speaking, this is a very general statement. As a profession and as predominantly a white female profession, we don't like to admit when we don't know something, right? Like, that's fair. I think that's just females in general, like, or maybe just humans in general, but like, but that's, we have to let that go. We have to be curious. And if we let fear take our muchness away, then we'll stop evolving. Because if you give me a group of SLPs, somebody in that group is going to have a little bit of curiosity. Okay, if they're a little bit curious, then ask them to take the lead. Pour the PFD courses into them, pour the dysphagia courses into them, and let them be like the lead consultant, like you would with like an AAC group or an AAC team, right? And then have it trickle out and grow out from that one point of contact. And I've done a ton of in-services on that. I've kind of flown all over, done Zooms on like how we can go about like expediting that person's knowledge and confidence and capabilities. I wrote a free PFD PDF, which is really funny, PFD PDF, but like whatever, alliteration. But I mean, and like on what to include that I've then turned around, given to the world, and then am working with some researchers to actually make sure that it adheres to current best practice. And we're going to try to make it like a free the basis for a research project to turn it into like a free international tool. That's a year down the line. And like, yeah, but we'll get there and this will happen and it'll be good for the world. But I do want to, if we can, before we talk about caregiver coaching, can I talk about the diagnosis for PFD and what that actually means?
So Michelle, do you mind telling a little bit more about what PFD is? Because I know we have some listeners who are not going to be as familiar with that term.
Yes, yes. I would preface this with everybody, if, as long as you're not driving, because if you're driving, don't do this, pull up Feeding Matters on social media. So Feeding Matters on Instagram or Feeding Matters on Facebook or their website, feedingmatters.org. They are the international nonprofit who was founded by a mother, Ms. Goldwater, who had triplets, and all of her triplets had pediatric feeding disorders prior to having this term to describe it, right? So she endured, for lack of a better phrase, like medical gaslighting. It was basically, your children aren't eating, this is somehow your fault, or we don't need to go here, here, and here. But she funneled her frustrations as a caregiver, as a mom, and created this nonprofit that eventually grew to bring on the greats in our field. I mean, like Joan Arvidsson serves on it. She's like the fairy godmother of pediatric dysphagia. I had her on the podcast. I was like, I'm going to faint from awesomeness.
I got really to sit beside her at a dinner and had the same. I was like, oh.
I know. You just want to like rub her. Are you real? But she is served on there. Dr. Kay Toomey, who's a child psychologist that like focuses on SOS approach, which has started incorporating neurodivergent eval and treatment. But all of these greats OT, PT, and our medical health professionals, GI, allergist, ear, nose, and throat, otolaryngology, pediatricians. So, and Pamela Dodrell serves there. She's the famous speech pathologist out of Australia. So all of these greats came together and created this consensus statement led by Dr. Gaudet. So it's Gaudet et al. 2019, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but it's a consensus statement for pediatric feeding disorder. And that's what gave us the term PFD. This information then went forth and was submitted to the American Medical Association because they actually own the ICD-10 codes, right? So in order to get a new code added to the international classification of, I can't remember if it's dysfunction or disorder. I don't remember, forgive me. But you have to have research to back the addition of a new code. We don't just throw out new codes, right? And they were able to get pediatric feeding disorder approved. So it went live October of 2021. So we're not even 2 years into having this code. And it is critical because the prevalence is 1 in 37 children under the age of 5 will have a pediatric feeding disorder. If we think about, to reference back to our earlier statements of how many of these babies are surviving, these kids are, they're surviving and they're thriving, but they're battling PFD. So pediatric feeding disorder is made up by 4 components, right? So the first one is your medical etiology. So what potentially known medical diagnosis does this child have? We could have HIE, Down syndrome. We could have gastroparesis. We could have a laryngeal cleft. We could have a cleft of the lip. We could have hydrocephaly. What potential etiologies, medical etiologies, does this child not have a diagnosis of, however, has signs and symptoms of? So they have signs and symptoms of eczema and psoriasis. Well, those are red flags for food allergens. They have signs and symptoms of GERD, but no official diagnoses because they have emesis post a feed, right? Or emesis mid feed, arching, turning, writhing, increased work of breath. It says where I'm writing an eval in my head. Or do they have blood in their stools, chronic diarrhea? All of these things, we have to know as speech pathologists that all of those signs and symptoms could result in a medical diagnosis by a certain medical professional. And that is why we have to engage in interprofessional practice. Because as the SLP, I cannot say patient has eczema, most likely has a dairy intolerance. I would lose my license and rightly so. I can say patient presents with signs and symptoms of this. Please refer to this specialist to rule out this. Okay. My constant reiteration to my student interns over the years, because I've had like every semester I would have a new student. That's what led me to writing Chasing the Swallow. The entire book is how one sign and symptom resulted in a referral to this allied health or medical health professional listed alphabetically, not any other hierarchical component. Not one is better than the other. It's alphabetized. And then how I close on that case study and how it impacted that child's outcome, right? But all that ties into the first component of pediatric feeding disorder. What's their medical etiology? Now, the child may have a medical etiology of oropharyngeal dysphagia or esophageal dysphagia or just oral dysphagia, right? That could go there in that medical, but they might not even have that at this time. We might not have an instrumental swallow eval. The second step or component of pediatric feeding disorder is feeding skill. And this is where we have an overlap with occupational therapists. And this next sentence I'm about to drop will like really upset a lot of SLPs, but I challenge you to sit in your uncomfortable moment, reassess how our field has grown and interprofessional practice has changed, and then move from uncomfortable to comfy cozy, because this is where we're at. Occupational therapists have every right to participate in a pediatric feeding disorder evaluation and treatment from the NICU to end of life care, because I am only as good as my IPP team, and those OTs know about reflexes that I haven't even heard about because it was not covered in the ASHA Big 9 in my grad school. And I need them to not only teach me how they see this child's dysregulation with respect to vestibular system, with respect to like, where are they developmentally with their reflexes? Did they get to go through that initial crawl after birth to latch on the mother's breast? I need that knowledge and where they are with those reflexes that are highly focused, especially on that hand to mouth stage, right? So you may have a 2.5-year-old that you're assessing, but they may not have surpassed past aphasic bite reflex because maybe they have agenesis of the corpus callosum and they're just stuck right there, right? So what tools and what strategy, what feeding skill can we use to progress them? So I came up with, and this is not part of the feeding skill component according to the ICD-10 code, but this is how like I wrap my brain around it. I created a term called food age, right? So like, this is how I explain it to my students and to my caregivers when I'm engaging in coaching, because they'll say to me like, Michelle, my kid is 18 months old. How can we still need puree food? Right. And I'm like, okay, well, hang with me and I'll tell you why. So your child maybe chronologically is this age, 18 months, right? But your baby was 3 months premature. We are extremely premature, right? So your child's adjusted age might be, let's go with 12 months because math is hard. Okay, so your baby is 12 months of age. So we're getting ready for that first birthday, right? But adjusted age, they're still only 9 months. Most caregivers understand chronological and adjusted age. So then let's take it another step further and go to developmental age. How are they developmentally? But if they had an infarct, if they have absence of tissue, if they maybe they had a congenital heart defect, but they had to be sedated for, you know, 6 to 9 weeks, because that's common with our CHD babies, they're missing those chunks of learning, right? So maybe developmentally, that child is like 9 months. So we've got chronological 12, adjusted 9. Now let's give developmental 7. But then we turn around and they've missed all those PO opportunities. They've missed those per OSH trials. And a newborn will feed 12 to 16 times a day. And if they're only allowed to eat once a week, they're not learning how to integrate those reflexes. So their food age might be that of a 6-month-old. They might be eating pureed foods. Maybe they're still on a bottle, but like, that's amazing. Fed is fed is fed, whether it be G-tube, NJ, like, or oral, fed is fed is fed. We're celebrating that your baby's turning one. Their food age is that of a 6-month-old, but you give me a Pyrex bowl and some pudding and some food color, and I can make you a smash cake that's going to make your heart happy, right? That's how I kind of take the feeding skill and tie it into a food age. And when I wrap that together, it makes sense. Now, is food age a mandatory part of feeding skill? No, but when I've added that term in, it kind of like helps click for some patients. So we've got medical, feeding skill, nutrition. Nutrition is the easiest one for people to wrap their brains around, and also the hardest one sometimes to get a referrals because BMI lies. Nutrition is what goes into a body. All right. For our infants, we can't really quantify a breastfeeding session. We can say patient is exclusively breastfed, but it's not like my boobs have a spigot to say your child consumed 3 ounces. But breastfeeding is one form of nourishment. It's not better or best than other forms of nourishment. In that nutrition section, when we're looking at that component of PFD, we write what formula they're on, the volume, as best as we can calculate. I like to include, if it's like a specific bottle, like what the bottle brand is and what the nipple flow is. If they're orally fed, I try to include the list of the foods. This is where it gets tricksy. Our FID, avoidant food restrictive intake disorder, we cannot as SLPs diagnose. That's a psych diagnosis. That's a DSM-5 category. We can't give that diagnosis. You'll still see children that have predominantly autism, and they're diagnosed with ARFID when in fact it's not an ARFID, it's pediatric feeding disorder.
But normally they're school-aged children, and that was a diagnosis prior to PFD coming out, but that's a conversation for another day. Please check the Feeding Matters website for the description and the journal article on PFD versus ARFID. Okay, so back to the nutrition side. Here's the catch from nutrition. A lot of pediatricians will act as our gatekeepers, and they'll say, but the kid's BMI is great, right? The kid may be living off of a particular formula that comes from the grocery store in a can that is sugar first and corn second and chicken nuggets. Your BMI is going to be great if your whole diet consists of sugar and chicken nuggets. I'm not worried about your BMI. I'm worried about your metabolic panel and what your metabolic panel is going to tell me. And what is your iron? What is your vitamin D? What does your protein actually look like? Because that won't be nourished. And I might have a hard time making a pitch to even pull in a registered dietitian, because the term nutrition implies to some people that may not know different that they need to see a nutritionist. But a nutritionist is not an individual that's certified or licensed to give medical nutrition counseling, only a registered dietitian. And if I have a kid that's got less than 5 foods, if I have a child that I'm eating that has less than 25 regular foods, but we're not hitting all of the food groups, then I'll request a CMP panel and a referral to an RD, not a nutritionist. And please don't, if you're a nutritionist, please don't think me think I'm being dismissive, but for my medically complex kids, I need the RD because again, we can bill insurance for their services, right? And then the last component is psychosocial. So we've got medical, we've got feeding scale, we've got nutrition, and then we've got psychosocial. With our adult patients that have dysphagia, we've got like the WHO questionnaire for PO intake. We've got, there's like questionnaires for like quality of life, squall, those kinds that we can give our adults, right? In the world of peds, we're really truly most of the times touching base on our caregivers, which is why caregiver coaching is so important, because it's the caregiver psychosocial skills that I'm concerned about. It's the caregiver psychosocial skills that how are they handling and processing this new adventure? What is their PTSD? Do they have signs and symptoms of postpartum depression and anxiety? Do they need support because their Maslow scale, they're trickling down and it's crumbling because they can't put their oxygen mask on to take care of the babies, right? And what resources are available to them? So like quick plugs, Feeding Matters has the Power of Two program that's free, where one caregiver of a child with PFD can support another caregiver of a child. They try to pair them after training. National Foundation of Swallowing Disorders has a second or third Thursday of every month, has a free Zoom webinar, like a Zoom meeting for pediatric feeding disorder patients and peds dysphagia patients and their caregivers to get together. Sometimes I'll volunteer, but if I know that one of my families is going, then I won't go because like conflict of interest, this is their safe space, right? Who else has a support group? I don't know. Dysphagia Outreach Project has free resources that we can, I'm like plugging all my favorite people, but like these are nonprofits that are literally changing folks' stars, right? But when I'm looking at the pediatric feeding disorder diagnosis, I have to document according to those four components and the severity of each one, and that determines the overall level of severity of the child's PFD. And when we break it down to those four levels of specificities, that drives who is on my interprofessional practice team, what referrals we pull in, and that all of that is framed around the caregiver, all of it.
Well, Michelle, I hate to stop you there, but I think where you've talked about the four components and how it leads you to who's going to be on that interprofessional team is a nice kind of stopping point for today, because unfortunately we've run out of time, but I'm going to have you back for one more episode where we're going to continue our discussion and talk more on caregiver coaching. And while it was not part of our plan, I think the conversation we had in the beginning where you shared about your personal history and the impact that our backgrounds bring into the therapies and the evaluations that we do was a nice add-on for people to kind of understand what influences how we evaluate and treat our patients and some of our, you know, considerations, and the idea that we all may need counseling and that there's counseling services available, and that we as speech language pathologists often act as a counselor. That's part of our role, is to counsel and provide support for our clients and our patients and their families. So in the next episode, we'll focus on that caregiver coaching and that interprofessional team and some of the considerations that you have as we continue talking, Michelle, about working with children with pediatric feeding disorders and with their caregivers. So thank you again for joining in.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.